Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of the channel, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting books. And this week I'm very pleased to say we have Andrew Demchuk on the show, and we'll be talking with him about his terrific book, The Lost German East, Forced Migration and the Politics of Memory, 1945 to 1970. I know a little bit about this topic, largely because we've done several other books about the expulsion of the Germans and what the Germans did after World War II. But I really learned a lot from this book that I did not know. And this was about what the expellees, that's not a very pretty English word, what the expellees did in West Germany, particularly after the expulsion. I knew nothing about it at all, and it turns out that they were quite active, as Andrew will tell us in the course of this interview. So first, let me say, Andrew, thank you for writing the book, and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Could you kick things off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure, absolutely. So I'm from Michigan originally, and in Michigan, I did my undergraduate degree at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids. And then I did a master's in history at Marquette University in Milwaukee. Then my PhD at University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, where I had access to 11 million books. It's the largest Dewey Decimal collection in the world. Yeah. And one of the largest academic libraries in the United States. It was an excellent environment in which to do the dissertation. Graduated there then with a PhD in history with emphasis on Central and Eastern Europe in June of 2010. And then as of fall 2011, I took a job as assistant professor of history at University of Alabama at Birmingham.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's terrific. I've worked in that library with the 11 million books, and by a weird coincidence, I'm from Alabama. Actually, I was born there, but my sister still lives there. But anyway, that's a side thing. Tell us why you wrote The Lost German East.
Well, that, you know, I have absolutely no personal connection with the former German Eastern Territories. And notably, also, Silesia is completely absent from my personal past. Silesia is the largest, was the wealthiest territory that Germany lost after World War II. And even though it's not in the title of my book, it was in the title of the dissertation and is sort of the case study that I focus on in the work. But yeah, I had no personal connection with any of these territories. And my interest was first piqued, as I observe in the foreword of the book, when I was in the undergraduate classroom at Aquinas College, and my wonderful history mentor there was moving through early German history of the German territories, and we got to Prussia. And there was a large map of Prussia that he, back then we didn't use PowerPoint, it was the old paper map with, the dog-eared corners and frayed ends, and he pulled the map over, and I saw all these territories inside of what is now mostly Poland. And I asked the question. I said, "So were these all territories that that were German?" And the teacher said, "Well, I mean, they were part of Germany." I said, "And I mean, so who settled there and what happened to them?" And all of this was sort of beyond the purview of the discussion. It was sort of this great blank space. And when I then looked up statistics and discovered that these territories had comprised one-fourth of Germany's Weimar-era territory, not including territories lost after World War I, I mean, just the Weimar territory of Germany. And then when I discovered that one-fifth of the entire post-war population of East and West Germany was comprised of these expellees, I wondered why it was I didn't know about this and what this meant for my understanding of European history. And, it was a situation where my mentor there at Aquinas was an early modernist, and I decided I wanted to be an early modernist. And so I went to Marquette University, and I kept telling myself that I wanted to focus on the 17th century, then maybe the 18th century. Soon I was in the 19th century, and all along my greatest interest was really the 20th century and this question of the expulsion of Germans. And so I decided to, although my master's degree was then in early modern history, and I don't regret that at all, because I think it makes me a much better teacher, and it broadens my view beyond the 20th century in wonderful ways. But I was able to sort of pick up these threads all the way through and pursue this project. And it was stimulated, in addition, as a sort of a last comment, by my travels in Germany itself, in Germany and in Poland, because I would broach the subject with individuals, and just about nobody in Germany knew anything about this. And the first trip that I took to Wrocław, which used to be the German city of Breslau, the second largest city in Prussia, one of the largest cities in Germany, featured in countless descriptions of these lost territories by expellees in the 1950s and 60s. When I went to this large city in what is now Poland, I believe today the fourth largest city in Poland, I went to the top of the cathedral, to the tower there, and ran into one of these German expellees. And I entered into conversation with him in German, and I said, how wonderful that we're here in this tower looking at your old city. And he said, well, yes. He says, I've been coming back to visit my former homeland, Heimat in German, intimate space where I felt at home, where I was born, since the 1970s. Since the 1970s, I've been coming back to visit this space, and it means so much to me in my life, and I hope to continue to come back. And then just sort of as a default question, I then ask, so then are you a member of the Landsmannschaft Schlesien, the Homeland Association of Silesia, which is sort of at a right-leaning, gigantic piece of the federal infrastructure, actually, here in Germany in the 1960s and 70s and periods beforehand, and associated very much with this desire to reclaim these territories for Germany. And I said, are you a member of this Silesian Landsmannschaft? And he looked at me horrified. And he said, absolutely not. He says, I'm actually a member of the Socialist Party, the SPD, and I don't want anything to do with those right-wingers at all.
People.
Yeah. Exactly. And he said, can't you understand? He said, we could love these spaces we've been from. We could maintain this connection and not be right-wing crazies. Mm-hmm. And that was really an important moment for me, having had this discussion with him, because I found this sort of mentality repeated time and again over the course of my research.
That's interesting. I spent some time in Germany myself as a student, and I had a host family, and they were expellees. I didn't know to use that word. They had a big map of East Prussia on the wall.
Ah.
They sort of explained to me, yeah, we were from here. And I said, oh, it's interesting. But they were very happy where they were, believe me. And they had a beautiful place.
Mm-hmm.
They were very well set up. They were really well set up. So I don't think they wanted to go back or anything like that.
No.
So
where were they settled, if I may ask?
They were just south of Koblenz.
Okay.
Yeah, just south of Koblenz. I mean, they're right on the Rhine. It's a beautiful place. And,
you know, gorgeous. Really,
yeah. He had his own Weingut and the whole nine yards.
Wow.
So let's see where to start. Well, I think most of the people that listen to this show know that as the Soviets made their way into German-speaking territories, let's put it that way, in late 1944 and 45, a lot of Germans fled, and once they took over the area, then there were mass expulsions that lasted about 3 years until 1948. And they were done with the cooperation of the Allies, that is all the Allies, not only the Soviets, but with the Americans, the British, and the French. So this was a part of the post-war planning that had been done, I think at Potsdam, I don't remember, but everybody was on board with this, which just shocks me a little bit. And it was one of the largest, I don't know if it's the largest, I hesitate to say that, population transfers in history. I hesitate to call it the largest, but it was big, involving millions and millions of people. And then these territories were given to Poland for various reasons we don't need to go into. So this displaced Germans, they end up in East Germany and in West Germany. So that's the backdrop to this. But let's begin much earlier than that. I'm an early modernist, so I'm always interested to talk about these things. How did the Germans get to Silesia?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, yeah, as I said, I had my own early modern background. So that was sort of a even though I was supposed to be studying other early modern things, my interest kept coming back to that very question. How did the Germans end up here? And we actually have to move before the early modern period into the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. So, of course, as many of your listeners, I'm sure, are aware, you know, nationalism is a modern phenomenon. And thanks to Benedict Anderson and Hobsbawm and others, we know that nations are often based around lingual groups, and they develop their identities, especially in the 19th century, etc. So when we talk about the Middle Ages, we're talking about German-speaking peoples with many different dialects in a context in which people are thinking often dynastically, religiously, and among other forms of identity. And it was in that context that the migration of Germans into these eastern territories took place. The Mongols, as some listeners may know, advanced all the way across Hungary, Poland, and actually fought their westernmost battle inside of Silesia near a town that was called Liegnitz, today Liegnitza. And in the aftermath of this Mongol advance that was fought back then by German and Polish-speaking knights, all thinking in feudal terms, the territories were relatively depopulated. And the Polish dukes and others who were administrating these territories decided that it was not a bad thing to invite people from the West to come in and settle and improve economic circumstances. And so it was in this context then that many Germans began to then move eastward from overpopulated areas in the West. One of these areas actually being where I am right now in Swabia, in southwestern Germany, where you had many families that would keep dividing the family plot smaller and smaller and smaller until soon you've inherited basically 1 acre and you're supposed to live off of this. So, you know, word spreads around that you can move to these areas of the East and set up camp. And so it is for this reason that many, many towns all across these territories of Silesia, of Pomerania, have towns that were constructed then in the 13th century, often with a very, what we would consider, modern grid street layout with the town hall in the center. And you have trade routes then that begin spreading from the core of the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation, then eastward into Poland. Even Krakow itself had a large German minority for a time. And then in a somewhat different trend, you have the Teutonic Knights, the various orders in what is now East Prussia, West Prussia, also establishing sort of their own domains. So the Germans then, these German-speaking individuals then interact with the Polish populations. Many of these German-speaking peoples ultimately begin speaking Slavic dialects. Other times, people with Slavic dialects begin speaking Germanic languages, and you have sort of this great mixing that then occurs.
And then, bring us up to speed. What happens with unification? I almost called it reunification. With unification, yeah. Where does Schlanz, because it certainly is called now, where does it end up?
Yeah, so Silesia, Schlanz in Poland, Schlesien in German. Silesia was always a very contested territory because it is an extremely fertile region in the Oder Valley. All of these towns had been founded there, and then even the first traces of industrialization begin to take root there. Silesia had been part of the Habsburg Empire, but was taken by Prussia in sort of its advance onto the stage as a European great power in a series of three wars in the 18th century. So that Silesia was then a core component of Prussia all the way through the Napoleonic Wars and into the 19th century with the unification of Germany. And it's really fascinating, as sort of a quick aside, the expellees after the Second World War never refer to themselves as Prussians. Ever. They are Silesians. They are Pomeranians. They are Lower Silesians, Upper Silesians, East Prussians, West Prussians, at whatever kind of designation you can imagine, all the way down to the most intimate local level. But they were never Prussians. I have never seen that designation, which is fascinating because, of course, the Rhineland was also technically part of Prussia, but had never been content as a part of Prussia. It had often resisted Prussian rule throughout the 19th century. But these territories they were an integral part of Prussia. You had statues of Frederick the Great and the various Kaisers all throughout the various cities, and yet this Prussian identity was not something that they wanted to attach themselves to after the end of the Third Reich.
Mm-hmm. So is it at this point that people in Silesia start to think of themselves as Germans after the unification, or is that tenuous to say that?
They thought of themselves as Germans, actually, at about the same time that individuals did across much of the rest of Germany, really, with this growth of a pan-German identity throughout the 19th century. And it's intriguing because this identity included Jews as well.
Mm-hmm.
The city of Breslau was home to the second largest Jewish population in Prussia, the largest, of course, being Berlin. And as Till von Raden has explored in his excellent book on the Jews of Breslau, of course, these individuals often were, because of their wealth, some of them were part of this three-tiered voting system that gave them a significant amount of political influence. And also, you have Jewish merchants, Jewish entrepreneurs helping to finance the creation of monuments celebrating the unification of Germany by kings of Prussia through the 19th century after the unification. So mm-hmm. There's this pan-German really succession after the absorption of Prussia into the new unified German state. So, which is interesting because Prussia had been a largely statist identity before the unification of Germany. It was supposed to be including, for instance, the Polish population as well. And so you have other events taking place in the 19th century, notably the Kulturkampf of the 1870s, where Polish populations in the Poznan and West Prussia region begin to feel like they're not part of this new rising German identity. But you don't really find that so much inside of these German-speaking populations.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest region of contestation, actually, after the First World War is Upper Silesia, especially the industrial region of Upper Silesia, which was the second largest industrial region in Europe, in continental Europe, so non-British Europe, outside of the Ruhr area. By the First World War. So it was an obvious war prize that the French wanted to see taken from Germany and given to Poland, of course, to weaken Germany, understandably, after the Germans had ravaged so much of eastern France. And so individuals in Upper Silesia, which is very different from Lower Silesia, Upper Silesia, which confusingly is in the south, much like Upper Bavaria, right? The further south you go, the more up you are. Upper Silesia, further in the south and in the east, they actually had a vote in 1921. Do you want to be German or Polish? Do you want to be part of Germany or Poland? And the individuals in this region, many of them were bilingual. You had a local dialect, which the Germans called Wasserpolnisch, water Polish. Not a very salutary term. Now we try to be politically correct and we call it Schlanzakisch. But this local dialect was in many ways the basis of its own identity, which is very much Catholic regional identity. And these individuals often then broke down by German or Polish affiliation based upon how the violence worked out in the midst of this 1921 plebiscite in Upper Silesia. I mean, my general feeling is that if a German Freikorps came through and burned down your house and killed your wife, you're a Pole. And if these Polish brigands that are crossing the border armed by France come in and burn down your house and kill your wife, then you're a German. And it is no coincidence in many ways then that it is in Upper Silesia that the Second World War began. In Gliwice, where the Nazis staged a fake Polish assault on German territory in Upper Silesia, the first victim of the Second World War was actually a Polish individual that they gave lethal injection to and fired bullets at outside of this station in a Polish uniform to sort of provide a corpse of a Polish brigand, right, who had tried to cross the border. And so it is in Upper Silesia, this contested space, that we see the war then break out. Under Nazi rule, then, Upper Silesia is not only reunified in the borders of the Kaiserreich of the pre-World War I Germany, but also expanded to include such territories as Auschwitz, which then for a brief period is also a part of Silesia.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Yeah. Know that. So, were the Nazis particularly popular in Silesia?
That varied, actually. The Nazis were notoriously popular in Pomerania, for instance, or in Brandenburg. But when you moved into Silesia, it shifted, especially in Upper Silesia. The Catholic Center Party and the Socialist parties tended to retain the upper hand. But the more you moved into Lower Silesia, then the more individuals tended to vote for the Nazis.
Mm-hmm. I see. So World War II is fought. The Germans lose, the expulsions take place, and you end up with a very large number of Silesians. You end up with a very large number of Silesians dead, and
yes,
you end up with a very large number of Silesians in East and West Germany. Can you talk a little bit about that population, how large it was relative to the two states and its composition, sort of in terms of gender and age and that kind of thing?
Absolutely. And these are all really important statistics to try to to imagine and also to represent, remember their problematic nature. Mm-hmm. This was a chaotic time. I mean, the Nazis forbade people to flee and, of course, continued to lie about the end victory that was at hand, so that the Soviets, as they rapidly advanced in the Vistula assault of January 1945, they were literally overrunning whole German towns and villages that were still populated, or people were fleeing. And it was a very, very cold winter as well. So individuals on an instant's notice suddenly leaving their homes, locking the door, right, and assuming that you're going to come back, right? You do all the things. Mm-hmm. You lock the door, turn off the stove, right, and you presume that you'll be coming back. And this, it's important to emphasize, is thus the first stage in what we typically call the flight and expulsion of Germans from these territories. The flight, the wild flight, is actually not even so much an organized expulsion as, oh no, the Soviets are coming. We've been hearing all about them for the longest time in Nazi propaganda. They're barbarians, and they're going to kill us all. And sometimes also the thought that, yes, and I also sort of know what Uncle Siegfried was doing, in Russia. We kind of have a sense, right? The rapidity with which people are fleeing is also in some ways revealing maybe something about what they may have also known, right? As they are fleeing, then Britain, United States, and the Soviet Union are meeting in various conferences. First, there was the Tehran Conference, then the Yalta Conference, and then the Potsdam Conference. The Yalta Conference takes place before the Soviet advance, and it was at Yalta, really, that Stalin was able to get basically everything that he wanted in Eastern Europe from Roosevelt and Churchill. The story goes that they were actually drawing borders in these territories with matchsticks on a large Russian map. And it has been revealed on a map that was recently found in an archive in Russia that the Oder-Neisse border that was supposed to be established between Poland and Germany was quite confusing at these conferences, because there are two Neisse rivers. There's the Lusatian Neisse River, which is the current border between Poland and Germany, and will hopefully always remain the border now, and the Glatzer Neisse, which is much, much further to the east. And Stalin had originally intended the border to be the Oder and Glatzer Neisse River, which would have meant that about half of Silesia would have remained inside of Germany, and over 2 million Germans would not have been expelled.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, because as soon as Stalin realized that Churchill and Roosevelt didn't know the difference between the two rivers and frankly didn't care, he even insisted on the other river and got everything that he wanted. And we have to also remember the context of the time. The Germans were extremely unpopular for obvious reasons. The Western Allies were currently firebombing many German cities, which is also questionable. Questionable merit, and the obsession by the American administration was to maintain the alliance with the Soviet Union so that the Soviets would join in the war with Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in this context that finally this Yalta Agreement is drawn up. A bit chilling, though, as well, that Stalin met with Churchill and Roosevelt at Yalta just literally weeks, not even weeks, days after forcibly expelling all of the Crimean Tatars from the Crimea. Stalin was an expert at moving populations before the Nazis even were doing it, moving them in boxcars to other territories, and not extermination, but forced migration. And this forced migration of the Crimean Tatars meant that the Crimea was particularly devastated, depleted of people, and it was in this context, sad landscape of ethnic cleansing that Churchill and Roosevelt figured that, well, the Germans did all of this and were especially upset with them right now, right? And, of course, the Germans were responsible for the brutal attack in the Crimea and across the Soviet Union. But it was in the face of this ethnic cleansing that this conference took place. So then Potsdam, summer of 1945, the Western powers, then Truman and Attlee, succeeding Roosevelt and Churchill, agree with Stalin then to move the remaining Germans in these eastern territories in a, quote, orderly and humane manner, which anyone who studied ethnic cleansing knows there is no such thing as an orderly and humane movement of peoples when questions of property are thrown up in the air in the midst of this sort of upheaval. You'll have rape and pillage and mass destruction and loss. It's just a quality of ethnic cleansing that, of course, the Nazis had already been executing across Eastern Europe. A context that must never be forgotten when we're talking about this. So these expellees range in their number based upon what book you read. I've seen as much as 4 million expellees die in the midst of the expulsions. I've seen as little as a few hundred thousand. The most generally accepted statistic is something along the lines of about somewhere approaching 2 million expellees died in the midst of these expulsions. And then, again, numbers vary, but circa 12 million then expellees made it into the occupation zones, the British, French, American, and Soviet occupation zones that formed what then ultimately largely became the Germany that we know today. And they came often in rather scattered groups. It was not the case that, say, a village might just simply find itself in the West, because some of the people in the village had fled earlier. Some were expelled later. Some individuals who fled sought to return back to their villages and then were expelled. You did have that case, too, because people did never assume that this huge piece of territory would be lost. They assumed, well, my farm is going to need the seeds need to be sowed. I have to get everything going. It's springtime, so people actually went back, often sowed the crop, and then left, and the Poles harvested it after they had already fled in the winter. The general trend, though, was that at least at first, a lot of Silesians ended up in Saxony, in what would become the Soviet zone, because it's of course on the border directly adjacent to Silesia. Many Silesians also ended up in the West in Lower Saxony, North Rhine, Westphalia, Hesse, in those areas. Many East Prussians and ended up in Schleswig-Holstein because they fled there on boats. And many Sudeten Germans ended up in Bavaria, actually, often, and Saxony. So there were attempts to redistribute these populations, but you did have cases where whole cities devastated in the war in the West became largely repopulated by expellees. And there were some cities that actually were constructed basically out of nothing to house the expellees, such as the city of Stadt. There's a city near Marburg that is called Schwalmstadt, next to Treise. And Schwalmstadt was basically constructed out of almost nothing after World War II as a place to house these expellees. Other times, whole new districts would emerge in these cities, often high-rise areas, where later, when the expellees became more prosperous, because the expellees were an important workforce in the economic miracle in West Germany, many of the expellees moved out to nicer houses, and these former expellee high-rise areas are now where you'll find your Turkish populations, your Russian-German populations, and other groups that are now more on the fringes of society oftentimes.
Mm-hmm, I see. So just to get this out of the way, because I learned something else, that I did not know that the West German government did not, what does one say, accept the territorial settlement of, I guess it's 1948, is that right?
I mean, there was
post-war total territorial settlement until 1970, whatever. What did the Allies say about the post-war disposition of Germany? What was it going to look like? Was there an agreement like, okay, it's going to look like this, and Silesia is not going to be part of it, and so they put their stamp on that, and they said, that's it?
Yeah, that's a really interesting story. And I think we can sort of follow it along in some ways by also looking at Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill blamed Prussia for World War II and wanted Prussia destroyed, right? And Churchill, remember, he's a British imperialist. So he's been carving up Africa and China and other areas for much of his existence, and now you're carving up Germany and eliminating Prussia. It's just another map, right? And you carve it up. That's a bit crass. But Churchill helps to dismember Germany, and they create this agreement at Potsdam that is then the basis for the legal definition of the border. But the final border delineation is supposed to be determined at a peace conference. The peace conference that was supposed to involve all of the Allies at the end of the war, a peace conference that never took place. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, the Potsdam Agreement of 1945 was always held up as this sort of de facto agreement that was supposed to determine that the Oder-Neisse rivers were the border. But as you'll see in so many atlases in school books all the way through the 1960s in West Germany, these territories were always stated as under Polish administration, because officially, by legal definitions, they're being administrated by Poland until a peace settlement can determine what the final border delineation should look like. Mm-hmm. And this sort of legal limbo in the West was not mirrored in the East. East Germany recognized the Oder-Neisse border basically at gunpoint from the Soviets in 1950 in the Treaty of Görlitz. And it was fascinating because when you look at post-war politics in Poland and in East Germany and in West Germany, this huge swathe of territory with all of its resources was always a huge question that could determine also the popular support and legitimacy for a government. The Polish government was not just communist, but really communist nationalist. They adopted all of the right-wing nationalist platforms of the interwar period, calling for territorial annexations in Germany, actually, as a way to try to gain legitimacy from a local population that didn't like them, that Poles didn't generally like communism. And so, and actually in some ways it worked out for the Polish government quite well. You're not allowed to talk about a huge piece of territory Poland lost to the Soviet Union during the Second World War, but we can talk about these so-called recovered territories, the Ziemia Odzyskana, that after an 800-year German occupation have now been recovered by Poland and are now now part of an eternalized Polish nation, right? All coming from a communist government. Really fascinating, because that's hardcore national dialogue. East Germany didn't have that. East Germany has to somehow convince its population, at first one quarter of which comes from these eastern territories, that, you know what, the border is permanent, everyone, and not only is it permanent, it's our new friendship border. It's the friendship border with our friends, our fellow socialists, the Poles, which East Germans didn't buy at all. And so I've always theorized that it may have been one of the bases for the 1953 revolution against the East German government, that you have all these expellees who are living, they weren't called expellees, they were called resettlers, Umsiedler in East Germany at first, and then later new citizens, Neubürger, and then they didn't have a name at all because they're supposed to be fully integrated by 1950, which of course isn't the case. But again, amid all this propaganda, the regime has to sign the Treaty of Görlitz in 1950 and recognize the border, which is a huge blow, destroying basically any remaining chance that the East German regime will ever have any popular legitimacy. And so in West Germany, which is the context that I'm looking at, which is supposed to be a democracy, my question was then, how is it in this turbulent post-war context, this turbulent post-war climate with all these refugees everywhere, that how is it that all of these expellees were integrated ultimately and weren't sitting on their suitcases waiting to go back to these territories that they'd lost?
Mm-hmm. So once the expellees get there and they get set up, I guess by the Allies at first and then by the West German government, they organize themselves. Into
yes.
these Landsmannschaften, these sort of, I don't know, what do you call that? How do you translate that? These things?
Yeah, regional association, land association.
Sure, yeah. I mean, but yes, right.
It doesn't really translate.
No, we don't have anything quite like that in the United States, at least. You know, we just don't have anything like that. So in any event, they organize themselves into groups, and they're big groups, and they're political groups, and they have their own publications.
Oh, yes.
And they have meetings and they have celebrations. Can you talk a little bit about the development of those?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So one of the first most basic needs for these expellees in the immediate aftermath of their flight and expulsion was to find other family members, other relatives. And very quickly, the old town mayor, the old village clerk, the old newspaper editor started to publish lists of names and addresses to help people find each other. Some of the old leaders from the old towns and villages started to try to agitate for better living conditions and often also for the right to return to these lost territories. After the formation of West Germany in 1949, it then became legal for people to start associating politically. Before that, under American, French, and British occupation, it was illegal to form political associations. And so, again, you have these local groups. We're just cultural groups. We're just refugee groups trying to find each other, or religious groups. The old town pastor, the old town priest would send out religious flyers that were also very much devoted to these lost homeland spaces. And if I could put out an historiographic aside, as I started to read about these West German associations, I was fascinated to find that the general assumption was that anyone who associated with these groups or went to these giant rallies they'd put together or commemorated the lost homeland, that they were generally revanchist, that they were generally interested in going back, taking back the lost territories, and reestablishing Germany in its 1937 borders, which was the official position of the West German government. And you had leaders, the federal minister for expellees, Theodor Oberländer, was a notorious war criminal who butchered thousands of people in the Ukraine during the war. You had a number of old Nazis who took up positions in these homeland associations. You had historians, scholars who had worked closely with the Third Reich and may not have been party members, all of them, but had created these claims to vast areas of Eastern Europe for the Nazi Reich. Now they're saying, well, now we're putting forth claims for these lost German territories. It was very easy to stop talking about the Untermenschen of Eastern Europe and start talking about the scary, dangerous Bolsheviks. And it was a very easy transition that a number of scholars have looked at. And so any association with these cultural groups, with these political groups, was supposed to mean that you really did want this territory back, that you were wedded to the political platform. And generally, those were your bad expellees. And your good expellees would be those who just simply accepted the material well-being they were all finding in the West and accepted the Cold War status quo and just integrated. And this material explanation, while important, just simply can't, I think, get at the core of what was happening. Not least because in 1952, the so-called equalization of burdens program put forth by the West German government, in which people who didn't lose as much gave money in a larger sum to the state to be distributed among expellees or people who were bombed out. The expellees, you have to imagine you lost your farm that your family was at for hundreds of years, or you lost a really nice villa. Some of these are nobles, right? You lost your villa, you lost your family estate in Silesia, and now you're getting a check for some paltry sum, and you're living in a high if you're lucky, in a high rise that's been built for you. If you're unlucky, you're living in barracks at an old concentration camp, right? I mean, Dachau was a leading place where expellees settled at first after the war. You're hardly going to feel like you're materially fulfilled, right? And you know, the economic miracle, I mean, in the mid-1950s, that's a long ways away, right? I mean, the flight and expulsion in the mid-40s. What I started to find then when I was looking, I started to read these Heimat newspapers that were widely distributed, often supported by these right-wing groups. And I found that if you flipped past the cover page that was usually some horrible incendiary political claim for the lost territories, if you flipped to page 3, 4, or 5, you started to find these poems, these odes to the Heimat, these imaginary journeys where they would return back. And I started to find this language in these accounts, in these Heimat papers, and memoirs that I started to look at and such, and interviews, of course, but that's problematic because it's contemporary. But in memoirs and materials from the time, from the even the late 40s, also in the 1950s and, of course, 60s, people were already accepting the loss of these territories, often because they were thinking about them so much, because they were going to these homeland associations. Because just because you go to a giant rally that has this political goal doesn't mean that you agree with the political goal. When expellees would go to these giant rallies, they often skipped the opening speech by the opening political speech, or during the political speech, they'd go over and talk to their friends because they were much more interested in seeing Heinz from Liegnitz, again, that I haven't seen him in years, and talking about the old town, or in seeing slideshows of what the old Heimat used to look like, hearing about stories of people who traveled back and seen it. This was of much more importance to them than hearing these political speeches. And this was the basis then for this process of dealing with loss that I observed as a widespread phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. What was the position, the official position of the major German political parties? And I don't even remember what they were. The SPD must have still been there. I don't know about the CDU. I mean, who Adenauer, what party was he a member of? I don't remember. But what did they say?
Well, it's interesting. Konrad Adenauer, who was the leading German political figure from the foundation of West Germany all the way through into the 1960s, Adenauer was from the Rhineland, and it was largely due to his influence that the capital was in Bonn, in the Rhineland, not far from his house. He hated he wanted Germany to be in the West. He hated Prussia. Being from the Rhineland, he saw Prussia as sort of an outside occupier. And his famous line was that Europe ends on the Elbe River. Europa endet an der Elbe. In the interwar period, as mayor of Cologne, he had been obsessed with establishing good relations with France. He had believed that a westward orientation for interwar Germany would be the best possible means of a successful foreign policy. So he really, after his own persecution by the Nazis, he kind of came back and became chancellor and continued to pursue this obsession with westward rapprochement, and, you know, with his back sort of facing the east. Being a good politician, he continued, of course, to give speeches that were in support of the 1937 borders and expellee political claims and such. So he paid lip service. But it's been pretty well documented that in private he had very little interest in these lost territories, which is interesting because the SPD's leader, Kurt Schumacher, actually was very much in favor of reestablishing some of the control of the territories because he was from West Prussia. He was actually from these lost territories. But Schumacher had suffered under the Nazis horribly and died really of his medical complications from what happened. And the SPD never really was able to rally any kind of response then against the CDU, the successor to the Catholic Center Party, the Christian Democratic Party, or the Christian Socialist Party in Bavaria, until the 1960s, really, with the generational shifts and changing cultural priorities.
So I guess one question that occurs to me, and I think probably to the listeners, is that did any sane person think that the West Germans or the Germans in general were ever going to get these territories back in any way?
Well, that's why I chose Silesia, because if any of these territories was a realistic objective, it was Silesia, right? I mean, East Prussia, for heaven's sake, it's been divided between the Soviet Union and Poland. You're never going to get you're not going to get it back, right? And or Danzig, right? Pomerania is not really worth very much, and the Sudetenland was not part of interwar Germany, but Silesia, well, it directly abuts East German territory. Of course, there's no common border between West Germany and any of these these so-called 1937 territories. But if any territory was going to be realistic as a claim, it would actually be Silesia. So that was and then of course with 3 million Germans having been expelled from expelled from Silesia, and with it being this rich industrial territory, agricultural territory, it would also be the first priority for recovery. So that was why a big reason I chose Silesia. And then I started to look at rhetoric, and again officially, the SPD, the CDU, the FDP, basically all of your mainstream parties are maintaining this lip service to the 1937 territories. And yeah, in school books, in instruction, you were continuing to get this rhetoric. This is all part of Germany. I mean, 1969, it's still in school instruction. It's still on the school maps. These territories are still under Polish or Soviet administration. Even Danzig, the free city of Danzig, the Polish port of Gdańsk now, which was not part of interwar Germany but was a free territory, free independent city under League of Nations mandate, was under Polish administration on these maps. So you have the official view that, of course, we're going to get all of these territories back. Among the expellee groups, I think a lot of them did fervently believe that some of these territories could be recovered. You start to see wacky maps coming out in which they're drawing Germany as the sinews of a person, or Germany surrounded by a lock with a key and you know, triple divided. You know, East Germany was actually the reference they would use for these Oder-Neisse territories, and what we think of as East Germany, communist East Germany, was Mitteldeutschland, Central Germany. Mm. And then West Germany. And so this rhetoric maintains, but really, I mean, among your average Bavarian, your average Lower Saxon, nobody, I mean, there's really not even that much interest in these territories. And there's a recognition of this at the government level. It's really the failure, for many of the expellees too, of the Nazi ideal of the Volksgemeinschaft, of the national community, of the German folk, because you get these Silesians that show up in the West and they're not welcomed, and their dialect is seen as somehow Slavic or other, or, you know, not part of the German folk, right? And then there's this indifference that arises in Bavaria or Hesse about these populations and their culture, so that the West German government actually seeks in the Federal Administration for Gesamtdeutsche Fragen, all German questions, is pursuing this all German question of these lost German territories and East Germany, trying to create the propaganda awareness that, you know, we had great German minds, great German explorers, German scholars who came from these Eastern territories. We all know that, of course, Copernicus was this great German national from Torun in West Prussia, and that, you know, he was in East Prussia for a while, and he's this great important Prussian, which is absurd, of course, because Copernicus, it's as absurd is the claim now in Poland that Copernicus was Polish, because Copernicus was writing largely in Latin and considered himself part of this early modern scientific community, right? He's not thinking of himself as German or Polish. But you get the sort of propaganda coming out to create the sense that these are important lost German areas. And of course, because so many of the Jews from Breslau had been important Nobel Prize winners and such, suddenly these Jews become upstanding Germans, right? Mm-hmm. That speak to the German heritage in these areas. But the West Germans, they don't really care. And the expellees themselves, their interest in the lost territories don't have to do with these political objectives. And even in the late 40s, they're already thinking of the lost homeland as a way to try to move forward, really, with their new life in the West, as a way of living off of their memories.
Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you point out in the book that many of these expellees developed a kind of romantic, a nostalgia for the Heimat in the East. Mm-hmm. And they wrote poems about it, and they wrote, and actually they had books about it. And but then this was countered in a way by another image of the lost East, and that is the lost East under Polish administration. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is really the core of my theoretical intervention, and that is these two images of Heimat that identify: the Heimat of memory being the one side, and the Heimat transformed on the other. The Heimat of memory is this, we could say, sort of technicolor image of the Heimat that emerges in their memories, where it was always sunny and beautiful in the Heimat. Everything was clean. Everything was so very, very German. Jews don't usually appear in these narrations, nor does the Polish border or any individuals who weren't German. The 1930s suddenly emerge as the most wonderful era in German history because the Nazis are not part of it. It's an era where we get electricity and we get running water, and often tied in with modernity. This is the idea that Heimat has to be this countryside idyll. Oftentimes Heimat could be a big city like Breslau. And, you know, Heimat is streetcars, or Heimat is factories. Heimat is somehow tied to this eternal but ever-evolving, wonderful, idyllic homeland that suddenly dies and is buried in 1945. All of a sudden, out of the blue, and we don't know why, so goes the narration, the Soviet Huns arrived, and the Poles, and we're not sure why they would be so upset with Germans in 1945, but they just seem to be, and they overrun and destroy then this Heimat of memory, making it the Heimat transformed, which is just as much of an imagined place that had never existed. The Heimat transformed is seen then as inherently decayed, dirty, neglected. The German language has lots and lots of words for when things are run down, nasty, and rotting. And they use all of them and to describe this horrible, horrible image. And it's often tied in with racial terms, very nasty terms. The idea that there are gypsies everywhere, or Mongols everywhere. Idea of Polish ineptitude in ability to manage anything, called Polnische Wirtschaft in German history, is often applied. These are not nice pictures, right? These are not things that we as historians, you know, want to see our subjects imagining, right? This, on the one hand, idealization of what was essentially the Third Reich and periods beforehand, and then this retention of often negative racial associations. associations with Eastern Europe. But as scholars, we also seek to say, well, then what kind of motivating force do these images have? And what I find is that more and more these expellees then wanted to reside in memories. They wanted to live in these imagined beautiful spaces that are somewhat loosely derived from what had actually been in their old Heimat. And they were increasingly alienated by the sense that this Heimat transformed, this negative image of Heimat, was ubiquitous and impossible to remove in these former Eastern areas. And actually, the obvious presence of Polish settlers in these eastern territories was also seen as sort of this contribution to the continued decay or decline of these areas. But of course, implicit is always, well, if we go back, these Poles will be there, right? Or are they going to be expelled? Or what will happen? Don't want to talk about that. Mm-hmm. Only rarely did some of these expellees, especially expellee leaders, even dare to talk about what they'd do with the Poles if they ever went back. And it was always very controversial. And so that's the basic image of the basic trend with these two images, and with time, even in the late 40s, to say nothing of the 50s and 60s, the separation between these two images becomes so vast that very few expellees had any desire to go back. They wanted to live in their memories. And this does not mean that they were happy with what happened to them. Doesn't mean that they ever really even accepted the borders. I mean, in their mind, the 1937 borders still exist as much as this Heimat of memory still exists. But it's all in this fantasy realm that cannot connect with the reality in which the world that they had known could never come back.
Mm-hmm. I have a couple more questions. Mm-hmm. I guess this question is a little bit critical. It's not critical, but I'm afraid I don't want it to be read the wrong way. Now, I would definitely agree with you that this idealized version of the 1930s in Silesia is sort of silly because the Nazis were in the picture. But on the other hand, what did Silesia look like in 1950? Mm-hmm. I mean, was it really quite a mess? I mean, I don't know. I mean, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no. I mean, it was a total mess. If you look at the city of Breslau, to go back to the metropole, at the time of the attempt on Hitler's life in June of 1944, Breslau, as well as Dresden, for that matter, were still perfectly intact. They were untouched by the war. So you had this city of hundreds of thousands of people, you know, at this point, is swollen actually by people who are fleeing from destroyed cities in the West. So you have a lot of people who've sought shelter in Silesia as well, from Hamburg or Munich. And so you have the city that traditionally is about, you know, 650,000 people, now even bigger, undestroyed. And it was the insane attempt by the Nazis to defend Breslau to the very last. And in fact, Breslau surrendered after Berlin. In the final months and weeks of the war, that Breslau was almost totally destroyed, very, very badly damaged by Soviet artillery. It was called the Stalingrad on the Oder because it was often fought house to house. So the Poles inherit this devastated city. And you have to imagine little things that happen in the midst of ethnic cleansing that we don't think about. They don't know where the water lines run. Mm-hmm. They don't know where the sewer lines are. They don't know how the power grid works. And sometimes the Germans, with that knowledge, had already fled, or they accidentally expelled them. I mean, they don't know. Occasionally, some of the people who knew about this stuff were retained, sometimes into the 1950s, to help rebuild the city. But you're supposed to somehow repopulate this horribly devastated city. Other places which were not damaged in the war are empty oftentimes, or largely empty, because the Poles just don't have enough people to fill them. And of course, not only because Poland didn't have as large of a population as Germany, but then the Nazis had murdered so many Poles, and of course, so many Polish Jews, that Poland just simply didn't have the population to inhabit some of these places. And the Poles didn't honestly think they'd keep the territory. There were cases where Poles crossed the old border from central Poland into Silesia, disassembled whole houses, trucked them back into a Poznan area and rebuilt them because they figured the Nazis the Germans, the fascists, right? They're going to come back. Mm-hmm. And so in this, you see towns that were not damaged, decaying. You see a town that, maybe the Soviets set fire to, that was not repaired in a timely manner. And I'll tell you, I really appreciate the need to keep, the roof of a house, intact, right? First order of business with a house, always keep the roof mm-hmm. patched, right? Because, as soon as, leaks begin to develop from the roof of one of these houses, or as soon as the pipes freeze, as soon as, vermin begin to get in, the house can decay with incredible speed. Mm-hmm. So that, yeah, I mean, these territories looked oftentimes pretty terrible. Mm-hmm. It was unequal. If you took a place like Glogau on the Oder, Glogau was 97% destroyed because it was also a fortress city. I mean, there was nothing. It wasn't really rebuilt until the 60s and 70s by Poland. Grunberg, just a little ways away, the Polish city of Zielona Góra, was not destroyed. A lot of Polish settlers happened to show up there, and it actually was a relatively prosperous city in post-war Poland. So you do have some exceptions, of course. It is quite uneven as you move across. But generally, yeah, things look pretty bad in these former German territories under Polish administration.
Mm-hmm. Just very quickly, so some of these expellees, they get the opportunity to go look at it again, to go look at the Heimat. What do they see, and how do they react to what they see?
Because I ended my study in 1970, which was the year that West Germany recognized the Oder-Neisse border for all intents and purposes, I only look at these trips up through 1970, even though this is part of a much larger story. It became possible for West Germans to begin to visit these lost territories in the mid-1960s, amid the Khrushchev thaw in the Soviet Union. And this was a surprise to me, just how many managed to go back. You actually have thousands of West Germans who, through various means that would take too long to go into, managed to go back and visit their old homelands. And on and off again then over the coming years, all the way up to 1970, they managed to go. And their intention is never to meet the Poles who live there now. They have no interest when they go to meet the Poles. Their interest is, I want to see the old church. Is it still standing? I want to see my old house. What's become of my house? What's become of my town? It was a very intimate local story that was very personal. If the local population came in at all, it would be, are there any Germans who still live here? However, inevitably, they did generally interact with the Polish population. It would often be as simple a situation as you go back to look at your old town, you visit the old house. The old house is looking kind of run down. You're not really happy to see it in that condition. The church, well, you know, it's not a Protestant church anymore. It's Catholic now, and things are really changed. And you go to look in the cemetery, and all of a sudden, a guy calls over your shoulder, hey, what are you doing here? In German, in perfect German. And you turn over, you look over your shoulder, and it's, you know, the local Catholic priest. And he says, well, why don't you come over and let's talk? You're the old Germans who used to live here. You know, I learned my German as a forced laborer under Nazi Germany, but now we can communicate because the Germans almost never knew Polish. And there would be this amazing interest in this case on the side of the Poles for what was this place before? Hmm. What was this? What is its history? We don't know. We just showed up here. We were often dropped off here, and this is where we're supposed to make our home. What is this place? And the expellees would tell them stories about what it had been, and they would also then ask questions about how things had changed. And sometimes you actually even found real friendships that would emerge from this. Germans would sometimes actually enter into the old apartment building where they lived, or the old house, and meet the Poles who lived there. And you get this situation where these expellees would mail blue jeans to their new Polish friends from the West, and the Poles would give them little mementos from the property, right? I don't know what this lamp is, what the history of this lamp is. Do you want to have it, right? I mean, you could take these mementos back. It was not always all sunshine, right? You had cases where the Poles let the dogs off on the Germans. You had cases where the Germans stole things without asking the Poles for permission. But nonetheless, you have the this interchange, this interaction occurring in the height of the Cold War at a time when these borders are not supposed to be permeable. And what did they take home with them? These expellees took home with them the idea that these territories are absolutely not the places where we used to live. They have very much changed. Sometimes they said, I'll never go back again. Other times they said, you know, I'm going to keep going back. You know, I can go back and visit. I can sometimes take vacations here. And after the 1970s, by the 1970s, as the border controls loosened significantly, you had individuals as well, like my Silesian that I met in Wrocław, in Breslau in 2005, who had been going back since the 70s and liked to go on vacation in the old Heimat. I'd like to go hiking in these hills where I used to go hiking. I'd like to see things that I knew from my childhood, so that you are actually a tourist in the old Heimat, where you're seeing how it has changed, sometimes appreciating how the Poles are now, by the 1960s, starting to fix things up, starting to actually develop their own tie to the landscapes. And especially by 1990, with the end of the Berlin Wall, things really begin to improve in these territories, and transit becomes much easier. And this story of travel, this long-term history from the 1950s up through the present day, is a story that I'd like to tell to much greater extent in a future project that I'm planning to move forward on.
Well, that's a good segue right there, because we've almost run out of time.
Yep.
So let me ask you our traditional final question on new books in history, and that is, what are you working on now? What is your next project?
Well, the project I just mentioned is sort of imagined as my third major project. I mean, the book which we're talking about today is my first project, the dissertation that was then revised and became the book. I'm here right now working on the second project, which I'll mention momentarily. But first, this third project, because it ties in so well with this one, this is really my intention to return to Silesia, to return to these expellees, and tell what will hopefully be a comparative history of trans-border interchange throughout the entirety of the Cold War and after, looking at individuals based upon gender, male versus female experiences, Protestant versus Catholic, look at the nobility, look at Jewish individuals who went back to visit these territories, looking at East Germans versus West Germans, examining what do they have in common in these narratives, also what things are different, and what can this tell us about how Europeans, Central Europeans, sought to move on in the aftermath of all of these upheavals that remade the face of East Central Europe. So that's sort of a future project that'll be based in large part also on my own private archive I built up in the midst of my dissertation research, as I put advertisements in these expellee newspapers asking people to just send me materials from travel experiences. And I was amazed to receive over 90 submissions from people in their 80s. The average age was about 85 of people sending me often original documents that I would actually copy and send the originals back of original diaries of excursions to these territories, photographs, poems, memoirs, just about everything, because they're dying out and their children almost never have any interest. And this crazy American who's doing research at the Herder Institute in Hamburg seems to be interested in the story and sending things. So that's, but most of these materials stemmed from the 1970s, the 1980s, from periods outside the realm of the study I was doing. Some of the materials came from former East Germany, which was also for reasons of concision outside the realm of what I had done. So that's a more long-term project. What I'm doing right now, I was very excited to get a Humboldt grant to do a year of research right now in Germany for a completely different project. I decided that it would be really good to move in a new direction in post-war Central European history, to broaden myself and enter into other historical questions that had fascinated me. So I'm seeking to compare the history of city planning and architecture in reconstruction in three cities that had been part of this interwar German space that were then rebuilt under three different regimes. Breslau, Polish Wrocław, is one of those cities. That comes from my first project. But then Leipzig in East Germany and Frankfurt am Main in West Germany, those are the other cities. They were all about the same size. The outbreak of the Second World War, they all had very similar, we'd say in German, Bausubstanz, the same sort of architecture, the same sort of history, because they were all old trading cities along the same medieval trade route, the Via Regia. And they were all largely destroyed to the same extent in the midst of the war. And so this intersection, of course, of post-war ideology and the very comparable need to somehow create a new identity in mortar and stone after the Nazi Reich is the basis of what I'm examining now.
Well, I wish you great luck with both of those projects. And when you finish them, please come back on the show. Let me say that today we have been talking to Andrew Demschuk and about his really terrific book, The Lost German East, Forced Migration and the Politics of Memory, 1945 to 1970. I really enjoyed our conversation a lot. I learned a lot. So let me say to you, Andrew, thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure.
And let me say to everyone who listens to this podcast and all the podcasts on the New Books Network, thank you very much, and I hope that you have a great week.